obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Johnny.
I'm glad to be here tonight, and I'm glad to be sober. I want to thank Michelle for extending the privilege of me participating at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It's my opinion, and I hope it always remains such, that it's some type of a privilege to be allowed to come and sit in these rooms. I have never been able to get it through my sick head that I have a right to everything that goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because I was lucky enough to stumble in here and get sober and stay that way. And the reason I tell you that is that everything that's good and decent in my life today is the byproduct of the God I discovered setting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm extremely pleased to be here tonight, fully clothed and in my right mind. And it seems like to me, the reason I tell you that is because a little over half a century ago, I came to in a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary, drifting in and out of total insanity. And because of a loving God who has expressed himself through our program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and eat like an animal. If I don't get nothing else out of this deal, I guess I can live with that all the way to the parking garage. Makes me feel good. Now, I'd like to stand here and take the popular theme, it seems like, today, and tell you that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. No, that's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, it kept me alive long enough to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I'm as sure as I'm standing here, if I hadn't taken a drink of alcohol, I'd have probably blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. Now, I don't know how most people feel about it, but it seems like to me that I was born needing some type of an answer. Now, I don't know what my problem is, so it's kind of hard for me to seek an answer. If you don't know what's wrong with you, you don't know where to look. But I knew there was something wrong with me. I was restless, and I was irritable, and I was discontented. I didn't like where I was. I felt out of sorts most of the time. I was the middle boy of three boys, and I was the only one in there that had blue eyes. Everybody else had dark eyes and dark hair in the family, so I knew right away there was a secret nobody was telling me. But you see, I didn't realize then, as I've come to understand in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm suffering from the symptoms, even then, of the most deadly illness that's ever been known to mankind. They tell me that there's written history. It stretches back, this illness that I have, it stretches back almost 4,000 years. Now, I don't know that. I know a lot about whiskey. Everybody in my family drank whiskey. They were just a kind of a little odd kind of these people. I mean, they were bootleggers, drunks, whores, just a real functional bunch of people. That's what they were about. And I remember as a little child going to the penitentiary to visit my namesake, my Uncle Johnny. I had no idea that I was getting some previews of coming attractions, for Christ's sake. But I didn't understand that. I didn't pay much attention to what was going on. If a therapist asked me in those days, and he probably did, if my family background scarred me, I'd have probably said, yeah. Because I was a victim then. It wasn't my fault for anything that was happening to me. But if he was to ask me that same thing today, because I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 53 years, I'd say to him, no, they didn't bother me. Because I was so involved in my own selfishness and self-centeredness that I didn't have the opportunity to look around me and see what was going on. I'm too worried about what's going on with me. I looked up one day, I saw my grandmother. Now, my grandmother lived when she was 90 years old, and she never took a drink of alcohol or smoked a cigarette in her life. My grandmother wouldn't think it's a big deal I've been sober all this period of time. She says, I ain't had a drink for 90. I told her, you ought to have a couple, Granny, make you feel better from time to time. My grandmother got everything she needed out of this church that she went to. I remember as a child, because I spent a lot of time with my grandmother because my parents were busy. And on Sunday morning, where they'd used her house for the war zone, my grandmother got up on Sunday morning, put the best thing she had on, and she walked away for a couple hours, stepped over the body. And when she got back, something had happened to her. She was a little easier in her being, a little lighter in her being. She danced around these people and cleaned them up and cooked for them and sang songs to Jesus. Now, I took a look at that, and I filed that in my keen alcoholic mind. Still, there was a lot of new people here tonight. I want to let you know that this is the only place in the world you're ever going to hear about the keen alcoholic mind. They're not going to mention it at the Al-Anon luncheon, I can tell you that. They may say something like the keen alcoholic got up last night and peed in the linen closet. But you see, because I don't know what's wrong with me, and my grandmother has something that attracts me, I feel that all I'm going to have to do is go where Grandma goes, do what Grandma does, I'd be like my grandma. But my grandmother's not alcoholic. Now, I didn't know that. So when I was a little child, I went and sat in church with my grandmother on Sundays, and I waited for what to happen to me, what was happening to my grandmother. And nothing happened. And I'd say things to her, Grandma, when's it going to happen? And she'd say, well, when you go down front. Well, I went down front. Nothing happened down there either. It wasn't happening anywhere I was. And then I said to her, well, it didn't happen. When did you get sprinkled? I went down there. All I remember about that, it was wet. I don't remember nothing else. But I've come to understand here that there was nothing wrong with my grandmother's church at all. There was just something wrong with the jackass sitting in it, me. See, what I'm doing, unbeknownst to me, I'm sitting in a room or I'm going around the world, I'm looking for something way out here to make me feel better in here. It only goes to prove to me that the problem has always been there. And what happened to me is one day I sit on the back porch with my grandpa, who was a bootlegger, and he's drinking whiskey out of a fruit jar, and he put it down and he went somewhere. Now, I don't know where he went, but I do know that I picked up that jar and took a drink of that stuff. And I guess, according to the only authority in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our book, the next couple of minutes is what makes me an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic because I spent the next 20 years of my life creating mayhem out in the world. I'm an alcoholic because I have some type of an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Now, it's not a bad reaction, if you want to know the truth. If it had been a bad reaction, you'd have another speaker here tonight. It's good stuff, man. And that stuff went inside of me and kind of stilled the madness. Took me from the black pit of nothingness, stood me into the gray fringes, the business of living, and installed in me some type of arrogance that said, damn you, world, it's all right. I'm not good enough to be around the good people, but I'm too good to be around the bad people. It's okay right here. You see, I wasn't ready for what happened to me next because I had no idea the mystery that was going to create my life for the next 20 years of my life. Because, you see, once I put alcohol into my system, I'm one maybe out of 10 people who has this effect from it. Once I take a drink of alcohol, I'm powerless not to take the next one. And so what happened to me from that first drink, 3 days later, I was pulled out from underneath a bridge and stood in front of a judge and sentenced to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol. They pulled me out of a car in Compton and stood me in front of a judge and sentenced me to 20 years in the penitentiary. Now, that's what happened to me when I drank. I got drunk and went places. Let's travel around. I went from reform school to reform school, the junior penitentiary, the penitentiaries, the nut houses. Now they call them treatment centers. I like nut house a little better. It's a little more macho. I always figure if you're going to be bad, you ought to be bad. I mean, don't quit drinking because you puke a little. Hang in there. Give it everything you got. Alcoholics Anonymous works a hell of a lot better when you run out of options. I threw everything into the battle. Everything. My health, my sanity, whatever talent God gave me, any opportunity that may have come my way, anything in my life, I threw it all in there. And at the ripe old age of 25, somewhere around there, when I came to in that cell in solitary confinement at maximum security penitentiary, there wasn't anybody left upon the face of this earth that would send me a penny postcard. They were all gone. But you know what? They should be gone. And I don't have any right to have any of them back just because I got sober. Not at all. They're just blessings that's come to me as a result of trying to practice the principles of this program a day at a time in my life. I was on a furlough from a reform school when I was a kid, and by this time in juvenile hall, I'd got indoctrinated into a gang, and I hang around my little gang, and we drink at a thing called Marco Petri red wine. Most of you never heard of Marco Petri red wine, I can tell. And the reason you never heard of it is because it was the experimental stages of Thunderbird. That's why you never heard of it. I remember one time I was having dinner years ago in a little restaurant in Palm Springs, and they had one of these wine guys. You know, he got them things over their arms. He's got his corkscrew hanging around his neck. It was real uppity kind of thing. We didn't have that in the barrio, but we had it down there in Palm Springs. And anyhow, he walked up to me, and these people are always joking with me about Marco Petri red wine. And so I said to this wine steward, "Have you ever heard of Marco Petri red wine?" He said, "Well, sure I have." Made me feel better already. He said, "But I don't know anybody who drank to live to talk about it." Jesus. But anyhow, I'm around my little gang, and we're drinking this wine, and I don't know what they're doing. Well, these guys tapped me on the shoulder and said, "You ought to try these." And he gave me some pills. Now, I don't remember saying to him, "What are those? Will they bother me if I take them?" Thank God they weren't X-Lax, that's all I can tell you. You never know what you could hear in these attitude adjustment meetings in the morning about that. I'm an alcoholic and an X-Lax taker. Let me tell you my story. No thanks, I've just had breakfast. It worked, that's all I can tell you. A couple years later, I'm on a furlough from another reform school, and I'm standing on the street corner of my little gang, and we're drinking this cheap wine, and we're eating these pellets, and we might smoke a little of that non-habit foreign weed, for all I know. And a guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm, ran in and out of institutions. That's what I do. So I live out there in the streets, and I do what people like me who live in the streets do. I destroy every single thing that comes in contact with me. I'm like a plague. There's a reason for that. I'm a taker. I'm a taker of things, and I'm a user of people, so therefore I'm a loser. I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm self-serving. Got an ego bigger than this whole room. My entire lifetime was spent before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, for a long time after I was here, maybe even a great deal of the time today. I don't have a handle on it. Without a conscious thought or a conscious concern for any other human being who lives upon the face of this earth. If you had something I wanted, I took it. And if you didn't like it, that's too bad. I cast you aside like so much trash and went on about my business. That's the way I live my life. No, I didn't live my life like that one day or one week or till the heat got on. I lived my life like that from my earliest recollection of life until a long time after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And therefore, the scene in solitary confinement that day is a result of that type of livelihood. I just burned everybody off. But that's what stumbled into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stumbled into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous on the fourth day of November, 1959. If I'd have known where I was coming, I wouldn't have come. Very simple. And if you'd asked me when I walked into the door, you alcoholic, I'd have probably hit you. If I'd have had a lie detector test on it, it wouldn't even have budged, because I don't know what's wrong with me. I'd never been called alcoholic. Been called a lot of things, but alcoholic wasn't one of them. And the reason I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was because the institution I was in let women come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it would soon be 53 years ago, to smell perfume. I've been honking and sniffing around here ever since. You got to be careful what gets you to Alcoholics Anonymous. The attraction is what brings you here. What keeps you here is what you do after you get here. Very simple. Now, that may have been the attraction that got me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's not what got me here. See, my last time out, I killed me for all intents and purposes. I'd had 2 years doing to me anything I wanted to do to me with as much money as I needed to do it with, any time I needed to do it with, and I came to strapped down on a bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail, 128 pounds of bright yellow, with a medical doctor standing at the foot of my bed and telling me I'm going to die. Don't seem like a bad idea to me. I just don't want to go on anymore. I'm not one of these foolish people tell you to quit working, because it would always work. It always will work. I just couldn't keep it up any longer. I couldn't stand the nightmares. I couldn't stand the thousands and countless faces of people I'd harmed or destroyed on my selfish, self-centered walk through life. That's when I was sober. It's when I had nothing inside of me. I couldn't live with the kind of guilt that I had created with the things that I had done, because I was never blessed with blackouts. I knew every single thing I ever did in my life, right up until the time I came here. Doctor kept coming back into that room every morning, looking at his chart, looking at me, looking at his chart, and telling me, you're going to die, son. There's nothing we can do for you. One night, because I had nothing better to do in the middle of the night, I screamed out probably the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. Now, there were no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, we got an AA meeting down there. I didn't get up and wander through the tulip somewhere. I just went to sleep for a little while. I'll tell you how sick I was. Two short weeks later, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on a bed I'd just gotten off of. And there's a good reason for that. See, in the back of my little mind tonight, just like it was then, I know what makes the big hurt go away. I know. Being an alcoholic, if you put me in the wrong place at the wrong time in the wrong set of circumstances, I'm going to be drunk. I know that. I know it. See, my little grandmother, who adored me, my grandmother, like a lot of people that have come into my life since I've been sober, knew something about me that I didn't know, because my little grandmother prayed for me every day of her life. Every day, her little precious grandson, Johnny. The last time I saw my grandmother, I was tied down on a bed in Manager's Clinic in Topeka, Kansas, and my grandmother was weeping and praying at my bedside. And I would like to have been able to tell my grandmother, God, Grandma, I love you, and I wish I won't do this no more, but I knew I was going to have to do it again. So I couldn't say those things. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I don't think my grandmother's prayers work, because I'm sure my grandmother's prayers kept me out of harm's way a great deal of the time out there. But I tell you something I know for a natural fact. It wasn't until I asked God for help that I could possibly ever get it. Something had to happen to me to put me in a position where I had to go to my innermost self and ask this power greater myself, God, please help me. I need help. And I don't know whether it was death I wanted or life I wanted. It was totally immaterial for me. I just wanted out of this dilemma that I was in. I didn't know. Shortly thereafter, I stood in front of a Superior Court judge. He called me a blood-sucking parasite in society. Said I had no right being around decent people. Told a woman sitting in the courtroom who was pregnant with my child, if you cared anything at all about that child, you'll never let this scum lay eyes on it. And you know what? The judge didn't say anything that I didn't know. Only that's the first time I ever heard anybody ever put it into words. I knew what was wrong with me. I knew what kind of a scumbag I was. I got the evidence to prove it. And so what happened to me is that my day, because I was so overwhelmed by the truth in this open courtroom, my brain kind of exploded and I drifted in and out of this total insanity thing for a period of time. And that's what stumbled into your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that day. That's what got me here. In my book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says in there that deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is the basic fundamental idea of God. It says that's where you're going to find him. You're going to find him nowhere else. Anyhow, I moved into that meeting that day. I remember sitting back in the back row. It was an old Quonset hut of a building. It was up in a mountain. I was sitting out alongside of one of these guys, and I looked up and saw two big A's on the backboard. Thought it was some type of anti-aircraft brigade. I don't know what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I said to this clown, I said, what is this? He said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. He said it loudly. But you know, I got a big image I'm trying to maintain in this place. I see me sitting around a bunch of lames like alcoholics, for God's sake. Well, a local from the hood, you know. I didn't realize that day, as I sit in that room, and if you're new, you may not realize it either. I was staring at an answer that I had sold my soul for. But I don't recognize the answer. I don't know what my problem is. It's hard to kind of seek the answer to a problem, but there was something there. And you talked about God, and I probably left or didn't leave or turned it off or something, but I found out there was a different group coming next Sunday, so I went and see if I could make fun of them. And I sit in the back row and make fun of them. And they'd say things that I didn't understand. They'd get at podiums like this, and they'd say, I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore. And everything is just wonderful. And back there in Inventory Point where I'm sitting, I'm saying to myself, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. I'm not drinking either, and I'm crazy. I'm going to go up and tear the guy's throat out, for God's sake. And see, what I'm trying to, I don't know this, but what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to equate this deadly spiritual malady that I have with a problem with alcohol. And I never understood that alcohol is the answer to this problem that I had. I didn't understand it. And you're telling me that that's your problem. Drinking's your problem, so just quit drinking. And I ain't drinking. And I don't know what to do about it. And so I think I'm doomed again. I'm not alcoholic. I can't be alcoholic. I cannot be alcoholic. But I kept coming back to those meetings. One day, a little guy by the name of Les Hamlin, a little man that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary, wandered into this place on a panel. He was my baseball coach when I was the star second baseman for the San Quentin Pirates for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, I put that on a resume one time. You ought to saw that guy's reaction to it. He said something, that all the great learned people who had been looking at me and prodding me and shocking me and doing all these things to me all these years as a ward of the state of California didn't seem to know. He looked around where I was sitting and he said this very simple statement, which means more to me today than it did then. He said, you don't have to live like this no more if you don't want to. You don't have to do it like this no more. Nobody had ever said that to me. They said to me things like, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problem. But what none of them ever took consideration is every time they told me that, I was as physically sober as I am this moment. How many times I wanted to scream at them, good God, doctor, don't you understand? Take it back to 1961. Before I had to stand handcuffed between two detectives while they buried my baby brother. And I'm responsible for that kid being put in that grave that day. Take it back before that thing when my mother didn't have that hate in her eyes for me. Take it back so I don't have to ever see that face or hear those words from my mother again. Look what you've done now, scum, you've killed our baby. Make it back then, you see, doctor, I won't have to do this anymore, but I don't know that. I just know that he don't know. And I know there's no hope for me. After the meeting, I went up to this little man. I said, how do you learn how to live, Les? He looked at me and he said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. If you go get that book, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. So I went over to the prison library the next day and stole the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when you got this big-time gangster image, you cannot let anybody see you signing out something as lame as Alcoholics Anonymous. That's lame. Lamer than lame. I snuck it into my cell. When nobody was around, I read it. And I didn't read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, practice these principles that are outlined in that book, and accumulate some type of a decent life that makes me comfortable most of the time and a purpose for being. I read it with the Losers theme song going off in my head. I'm going to read your book, and I'm going to prove to you my case is different, and then I'm going to tell you so in open meeting. The Losers theme song in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't understand. My case is different. The guys I sponsor start speaking that crap to me. I start speaking Mexican to them. Adios. And if you think your case is different, I can say it to you. Hasta la vista, baby. Moments very quick here. And so I read in this book something, the doctor's opinion, that described something called the phenomenon of craving. And I thought about that. Thought about it. It haunted me. And so I started to think back over my life, and I started to think about things that had happened to me. I started to think about the athletic body that God had given me that was capable and had the opportunity to play Major League Baseball. When I was in a boys' home in the San Fernando Valley, I was offered a scholarship to play baseball for a major university in Los Angeles. 1951 in San Quentin, I was given a contract to play baseball for the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, I never got to UCLA to play ball, nor did I get to St. Petersburg to play ball for the Cardinals. And I thought, for a long time, it's because where I came from the people I came from that gang I joined at Juvenile Hall, from the things that I did, the police and the stool pigeons, on and on and on and on. I was a victim before it became popular. I It had dawned upon me, therefore, that the reason I didn't get to do any of those things is I took a drink. And then the drink took a drink, and then the drink took me.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Right then and there, I did something that I did this morning, and I did it while I was sitting at the dinner table tonight. I assume the responsibilities for my own actions, whatever they are. Whatever. It's nobody's fault. Not my people's fault. It's not my gang's fault. It's not alcohol's fault. It's not heroin's fault. It's not the state of California and the penal system's fault. I'm the guy that did it. I am the guy that did it. I'm the one who committed the atrocities. I'm the one who used the dope. I'm the one who did the things that I did, and I stand fully responsible for my own actions, today as well as then. Shortly thereafter, I walked out of a man's office when I was in that penitentiary. I just spent 3.5 hours with him telling him about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done in my life. I told that man things that day that would have kept me in the penitentiary for the rest of my natural life. There's a good reason for that, because my book, Alcoholics Anonymous, tells me that I have to be thorough and fearless. Hold back nothing, it says, because I'm trying to build an ark to walk a free man. And if you're an alcoholic like me, and you're caught in the bondage of self the way I was, nothing is more attractive than some type of freedom. And I'm not talking about being out of a penitentiary or being out of a treatment center or being, I'm talking about freedom here. This freedom. To be able to do anything, to see somebody and just love them unconditionally. What a tremendous thing that is. I walked out of the penitentiary on the 4th day of June, 1961. The only thing I was armed with that I'd never been armed with when I walked out of those other institutions all my life was I had tried to incorporate the first 9 steps of our program of recovery in my life without anybody else's help but the book. Because I found out that if I did certain things happened to me. And I found myself running around in the penitentiary trying to help people. Now that's strange. They thought I was weird then. But once you start showing your way out of this thing, you really get kind of, my God, Weddle, what's wrong with you? You know them people are alcoholics? I guess. I said to myself somewhere in that penitentiary when I was caught up in a program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't been indoctrinated into a fellowship yet. Only a program for recovery, I said to myself, if they give me the privilege of coming and sitting in their meetings, I'll do anything they ask me to do. You know, it's been 52 years and a couple months since I walked out of that penitentiary. And in all that period of time, I've done just about everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has asked me to do. And I can stand here tonight and tell you I don't know anybody who lives any better than I do. I know a lot of people who have more things than me. But that doesn't mean they live any better than me. I sleep real well at night. It's amazing to me how much peacefulness and the coexistence I live in my life, no matter what the turmoil of the outside world is going and doing, what it's like to just to be able to see somebody that you just love. I mean, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. I never uttered that word to another human being prior to coming to this program. I went to a meeting one night, a guy walked up to me by the name of Norm Alpe and told me he was going to be my sponsor. I don't know anything about sponsors. I said, what's that, Norm? He said, I'm going to help you get things done that need to be done, Johnny. I said, what do you want me to do? He said, "Why do you ask me?" I said, "You just told me you were going to be my sponsor." And he gave me one of these all-knowing things that sometimes gets lost in some of the transitions in AA today. He said, "John, if I can't run my life, what the hell makes you think I can run yours? Now I'm doomed again." I said, "What am I supposed to do, Norm?" He says, "Why don't you just do what I do?" I said, "What is it you do anyhow?" And he gave me this great answer. "Well, if you do what I do, then you'll know what I do." How simple is that? Kind of like a monkey see, monkey do thing. You know what I mean? Be careful, you newcomers. There are people running around here in monkey suits, ain't monkeys. Oh, they tell you all kinds of stuff. Crazy stuff. That don't make sense to the alcoholic mind. "Oh, don't drink no matter what." Do you know that alcoholics drink no matter what? But they tell you, where'd that come from? 90 meetings, 90 days. You know, like what the book said. If you don't believe you're alcoholic, go drink, for Christ's sake. Oh, I forgot how sensitive we are in AA today. I tell you, he's mean to me, that sponsor of mine. You know what he told me? The first thing he said to me? "Why don't you get a job and go to work? You're a bum." I told him, "I'm not a bum, Norm." He said, "What are you?" I said, "I'm an AA member." He said, "You're an AA bum. Bums don't work." "You should get off of welfare," he said to me. I damn near hit him. "Ray, I ain't never been on welfare, Norm Alp. You ever say that to me again, I'm going to hit you." He said, "What do you call living in penitentiary? Self-supporting through your own contribution?" I think that's cruel. Then he said I couldn't drive a car because I didn't have a driver's license. So I'd have to call him up and ask him to come and get me, take me to meetings. Norm, I know you're going by here on the way to me. Will you come by and pick me up and take me to a meeting? I'll be by there at 6 o'clock, jackass. Be down the street corner. I ain't waiting for you. See? What happened to all this love and stuff we have around? I remember one night, I'd spent, I don't know, 10 minutes or so begging him to come by and pick me up and take me to a meeting because I didn't have a car and I didn't want to ride my little girl's bicycle to meetings again. I'd get tired of that little pink bicycle with a bell on it. He drove up. I looked at my, stuck my head in the window. I said, "Where are we going, Norm?" He said, "We ain't going nowhere." And he drove off. God, I felt bad about that. And I said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "Johnny, you called me up and you practically begged me to come and get you and take you to a meeting, didn't you?" I said, "Yes, I did, Norm. I really needed to go." He said, "And then you stuck your head in the car and said, where are we going? Where did you think we were going, jackass? To a dance? That's a loser's place. That's AA light. More dances, less meetings." I know how you can't hardly wait for the music to start tonight. Find her in the corner somewhere. Only problem, if you're both from sober living house, you ain't got no place to go. I don't really judge. I just observe and make remarks to you about things. The day finally came when I got a car. I didn't tell Norm I was going to get a car. But I not only had the car, I had insurance money, and I had a valid driver's license. I just drove over to his house and honked the horn. He come walking. I never forget this. If I lived to be 1,000 years old, he had on one of them tank top kind of undershirt things. And he looked at me, and he looked at that car. He looked at me, and he looked at that car. He said, "Johnny, maybe you're starting to get the idea." And I said, what are you talking about? He says, maybe you're starting to get the idea that there ain't a damn thing special about you just because you got sober. That you got to do all the things that everybody else has always done, only in your case, you got to do it more so than anybody else. Man had wisdom beyond his wildest imagination. Then there was an old man in Orange County who basically adopted me, the only family I'd ever known in my life. And I used to ride around in the car with him all the time. He talked to me about things like a father talks to a son. And I loved him beyond all. I guess it was the first human being that I ever loved unconditionally. But he'd say things to me. I'd say to him, I'd try to get literature to show him, you know, so I'd have something to talk about because I was sitting there. And I remember one night we were somewhere and I picked up this literature, Why We Were Chosen. And I said, I want to read this to you, Papa. We're coming back from Santa Maria. I got a long way. I thought maybe I could get in a few words. He said, okay, son, read it. And I said, Why We Were Chosen. He said, stop, throw it out the window. He said, what makes you think you're chosen? It said, it says here in this literature. He said, we're not chosen. He said, what makes you think you're chosen? I said, well, for one thing, my mother, who is a far better person than I'll ever dream about being, can't get sober and stay sober. And yet I'm sober. Why is that? He said, well, that's very simple, son. I said, I don't know that. He says, you've come to understand you're one of God's kids and you act like it. I said, what do they act like? He said, oh, I don't know. They just wander around and try to help people get things done that need to be done, and they do it for free, and they do it for fun. What a novel concept of acting like one of God's kids and being treated like one of God's kids. My life has just been a collection of wonderful things because I've had an opportunity to go things and see things and stick my hand out and help people and also doing by being helped. It's the most amazing thing. And I can't stand it. Every meal I've eaten has been a banquet. There's been business failures. There's been divorces. There's been affairs. There's been this. There's been that. There's been one thing right after another. But I never have quit coming to you. I never have. One of the great blessings in my life, that when my papa was so sick in his last year of life, I got to help take care of him. I got to do what he did for me when I was new. I put him in my lap and I rocked him to sleep, told him I loved him. And I wouldn't trade that year that I lived with the pain and the suffering of knowing I was going to have to go down and watch that beautiful man shrivel up into nothing who'd done so much for me. And I knew I was going to lose him. But you know what? I haven't lost him. Not at all. See, I don't believe that anybody that's close to you is ever going to leave you. I believe he's going to be here. I believe he's with me here tonight. I believe he's with me wherever you go. I think as long as I can remember, he's alive. That he lived in my life and what he left for me. This great legacy that he gave me of trying to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. It's the most miraculous thing that I know of. How would he die if I try to carry on that legacy? I wouldn't be able to do anything. I wouldn't be able to say that was my papa and I loved him. I wouldn't be able to. And everywhere I go, I hear things like that. I hear things from places that I never expect to hear things like that. It's the most amazing. This is the most amazing. You're new enough, you can't possibly imagine what this is all about. You can't possibly imagine what it's like to see somebody and want to put your arm around them and give them a kiss and carry on with them. Just like it's just the most amazing thing that I know of. I didn't do think like that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not at all. Not at all. I did not have the ability, or my ego was so magnified I could not tear down this wall and allow you to know that I cared for you. I remember sitting with my mother time after time after time in one institution after another, in one courtroom after another, juvenile hall, Whittier State Reform School, Preston, San Quentin, Folsom State Penitentiary. My mother said the same thing to me. Johnny, if you love me, you wouldn't do this. You would change. And I wanted to say, Mom, dear Mom, I won't do it no more. But I knew I could not do it because I had no idea that there was anything like this anywhere in my life. Everything was dark. Every day is going to... Hell is a day after day after day after day of hell. Painful, agonizing hell, where you get the memories and the agony of life over and over and over again. It's just like walking in the sunshine. I didn't realize that day when I walked into my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that somebody was going to open the gates of hell and let me out of there. I didn't even know I was in hell. But I know what it's like to live in heaven, too. Heaven's any better than what I got today, and around the people I'm around today, I can't hardly wait to get there. No, I'm not going to buy a ticket on the next bus to get there. But it really doesn't seem to bother me anymore. Not at all. It's, you know, my sponsor Norm, 30 years ago in June, dropped dead very quickly. And I'm kind of lost because Papa's sick. Norm is dead. So I don't know what to do. I'm sponsor a lot of guys. I travel all over the world, being an example of AA. My ego is bigger than this whole room because I have to talk, you know. Multitudes, the international conventions, the whole enchilada. And so I turn around, I'm getting all this information about who I should have as a sponsor. So I found myself doing something that I needed some information about. So I went and called a guy by the name of Clancy and went down to talk to him. And I gave him this great problem that I had and how I'd solved it. And he told me how to solve it. And I'd already solved it that way. So I, what do I need a sponsor for? So I turned to walk out of his little old dingy office. And I tell you, I felt a cold chill down my spine that night. And he said, I turned and looked at him and I said, Clancy, I need a sponsor. I thought he was going to say to me, what an order, I can't go through with it. So he said, I said, what do you want me to do? Which seems to be the question that all sponsors want somebody to say to them. I said, why don't you come to the Wednesday night meeting and call me every day? 30 years have come and gone. I still go to the Wednesday night meeting, and I still call Clancy every day. Somebody said, why do you do that? I said, you hadn't told me not to yet. And we have a very strong relationship. You can't be together. Both of us sit together on Wednesday night. We got over 100 years of sobriety sitting in two chairs. It almost feels like the building's tilted, for Christ's sake. They're afraid to light matches. We're afraid we'll explode from dryness over there. It's a great relationship. Better than any better than a relationship with some of the people in this room. Some of these people are closer to me than my own family are. Some of them I've shared more of my life with than others. And I sit up here and look at these four people up here on this podium. They're like my children, for Christ's sake. Watch them through their trials and their tribulations. I never shut the door on them and told them, go away till you find an answer. I just put my arms around and told them I loved them. That's what you did for me. No matter what kind of a backward person I was, and there was no people like me in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here with my background. You didn't care, you just loved me. You just come and sit with us. Stick your hand out. Go to institutions. Try to find somebody in there that you can help. I go to a place every year, a place called Folsom State Penitentiary, that I sat in on a transfer one time when I was 21 years old and bulletproof. And I go there every year and I get to talk to 300 or 400 hard shell convicts. The banquet. I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, I walked out of there and the warden always escorts me around. He likes me for some reason or other. Because he's looking, he can't get promoted. He's as high as he's going, and I can't help him anyhow. But he puts his arm around me, walks me around there, takes me to see my old cell where I played ball, and mess hall that I ate in, where I took showers, and just a real tour, you know, like going back to campus or something. And I walked out of this one particular day, and I'm very down about it. And he said to me, Johnny, what's the matter with you? I said, I don't know. I just don't feel good. He says, my God, man, you're walking out of the penitentiary. And I said, that ain't got nothing to do with it. He said, well, what is it then? And I said, you really want to know, warden? And he said, yes. I said, talked to 300 or 400 hard shell convicts, not inmates, hard shell convicts. Most of them time starts at 20 and goes up, and most of them are never going to get out of that penitentiary. And I says, and for the few who are going to come out of that penitentiary, probably most of them will never darken the doorways of Alcoholics Anonymous. That makes me sad. He said, then why do you come? My God, he said, you buy a plane ticket, you fly up here, you stay all night, you talk to this thing, you wander around with these guys, they call you homie. You know, you give me the sign as I walk through the yard, for Christ's sake. Some of them even quit playing handball, come over and give me a sweaty hug. And I said, well, if you really want to know, I'll tell you. Maybe one of these days, one of these days, there'll be another Johnny Harris sitting in the back row of that meeting someplace. Maybe one of these days. And if there is, then I can do half as much for him as you people have done for me. I know I will be in favor in my God's eyes forever. Because I don't know anything more precious than a human life here. And don't for a moment doubt that what we play here every single day is, I bet my life. I bet my life that you're right. Every single day of my life. I'm walking with a serious, deadly illness. And somehow or other, I've been given a day to reprieve because people like you, in rooms like this all over this world, you've had me come and share with you my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm the one who gets all the benefits from it. I'm the one who gets to watch them say to me, I heard you talk 30 years ago somewhere. I'm the guy that's watched them walk out of penitentiaries and make something out of their lives. I'm the guy that I put my arm around them and they put their arm around me and gave me a kiss. I'm the guy that gets that. That's the benefits in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on a plane coming back from where, well, not very long ago, and I'm thinking about this, and I was thinking, I wonder why I've been given this gift. I wonder why. My mother drank herself to death. I wonder why I've been given this gift. And I thought about it. I know it's not because it's to have a house. I got one, but it's not the reason I've been given this gift. It's not to have a host of friends, although I have a host of friends. But that's not how I was given this gift. it's not to make a lot of money, because that's not what I was given this gift. I have come to understand that the only reason God blessed me in my deathbed is so that I could be alive to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I don't have any other purpose for being. And I believe that as long as I keep that foremost in my mind, and I'm willing to share my experience, strength, and hope with anybody that wants it a day at a time, I'm sure I'm going to be able to embrace this gift and keep the gift of sobriety until they pat me in the face with a scoop. But I also believe that if I ever get to the point that I'm too busy, too blessed, too sober to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers in any capacity, in any place that I'm asked to go to, then I don't think that I'll be able to stay sober, because the gift will be gone from me, because I will abuse the gift. I love you very much, you know. I want you all to stay very sober. I want you all prosperous and grow. But I know I'm in a gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know some of us are going to drink again, and some of us are going to die from it. Some of us are going to go insane from it. And some of us are going to walk along on the sunny side of the street. All I know is that every living thing I have in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. Every living thing I ever hoped to have in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. And dear friends, please believe this. It is a long, long walk from a cell in solitary confinement at a maximum security penitentiary to where I stand right now. But for AA and good people like you, I could have missed it all. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.